Shrink Wrap Radio number 774. Stephen Porges, PhD, on the importance of polyvagal safety.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest is Dr. Stephen Porges, whom I interviewed 10 years ago on the polyvagal theory, of which he's the originator. He is a distinguished university scientist at Indiana University, where he's the founding director of the Traumatic Stress Research Consortium in the Kinsey Institute. He has published more than 350 peer-reviewed scientific papers across several disciplines, including anesthesiology, biomedical engineering, critical care medicine, ergonomics, exercise physiology, gerontology, neurology, neuroscience, obstetrics, pediatrics, psychiatry, psychology, psychometrics, space medicine, and substance abuse. Today, we are going to be discussing one of his most recent books, Polyvagal Safety, Attachment, Communication, Self-Regulation. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Stephen Porges, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's good to be here, David. Nice to see you again.
Well, yeah, again, it's hard to believe, but it's been 10 years since our first and last interview, which was on polyvagal theory. And it's clear that during that 10 years, you've been very busy refining the theory and growing a large cohort of like-minded scientists and therapists. What can you tell us about the growth of polyvagal theory and the community around it?
Well, it's a good question, because as a, basically, I would say, laboratory scientist, I had to develop a language that was accessible to the clinician. And it's been an interesting journey, because scientists are so self-evaluative and self-critical, and they really don't even like any of their work to be used as a metaphor or as constructs.
Yeah.
And I started to realize that the only way into an application, a world of application, was where people started to see things in terms of constructs, not in terms of measurements like the laboratory guy, the other hat. So I had to, in a sense, I would say, be a clinician at heart, or be an applied person at heart, which didn't come that easily. Because of all the years of acculturation.
Sure.
But I still remember being introduced as a scientist with a heart like a clinician, and I can't think of anything nicer.
That's a right.
Compliment.
Yeah, right. And we're going to be discussing your most recent book. You have so many books, and I read in your bio over 350 publications. And then on top of that are a bunch of books. Lost track of how many books, but you have been just so prolific and active. And so we're going to be discussing your book, Polyvagal Safety, Attachment, Communication, and Self-Regulation. And there are probably many paths through which one could start talking about the polyvagal theory. This book focuses on safety. Why is safety important here?
Well, you start, okay, so as the theory evolved, you know, I had to be taught about life through the theory as opposed to imposing my view of life in the theory. I had to be taught by a theory because the theory was really a recalibration or a redescription of who we are, our human evolution, or basically mammalian evolution. And what we learned from this understanding that journey, in a sense, mapping that journey, is that something happened to the nervous system of mammals relative to their reptilian ancestors. They developed a mechanism to turn off threat reactions. So it's not, and we're still confused because we think that safety is removal of threat. That's not what our nervous system it defines as safety or operationalizes as safety. We operationalize safety as special cues of trust and where we feel safe in the presence of other. And it's a very interesting process because in developing the theory, I coined this term neuroception.
Yeah, which was, I thought that was a very interesting word. I hadn't encountered it before. But
it's a new word, David.
Yeah, it's a great word, particularly the way that you define it, because I couldn't guess it from the word itself. But you're talking about our ability to respond, to make ourselves safe at an unconscious level. And I think that's really key, because when you really need safety, you don't have a lot of time to think about this threat, right?
Yeah. Right. We're such a cognitive organism. So like even in your description, we don't have time to think about it. It's a felt sense, and we have to really start respecting felt senses. And if we think about where the zeitgeist about, you know, human intervention models are, it's really about being re-embodied or safe within one's body, get rid of numbness. When we say get rid of numbness, the neurophysiology is let the feedback systems in your body do their job. Don't turn them off. Yeah. And so we need a total restructuring of understanding. But the word neuroception, that was a battle I had within myself because I didn't like the word perception because it implied an awareness or decision making. So I perceive something. What if I don't perceive something, or do I start blaming myself that I miss those cues? And people do that. Yeah. Damn, I should have picked up on those cues. But neuroception is in a different level of our nervous system. It can utilize some high up circuits in cortex, but not awareness. And so it's our nervous system's ability to detect risk in the environment, cues of safety and cues of danger and life threat. And I separate danger and life threat as being different, categorically different cues. And in the trauma world, the people know that. They know it's not, they're not just scared. They're feeling that their body is just disappearing. But coming back to this notion of evolution, virtually every living organism has a neuroception or primitive neuroception to detect danger and threat. And in the world of psychology, in the world of neuroscience, in the world of stress physiology, it's all been about threat reactions. And even in the world of medicine, inflammatory responses, all these things are threat reactions. They're part of, with COVID, it's part of a complex threat reaction.
Something that the killer in me has noticed recently is that tiny, tiny little organisms that get into my house that aren't supposed to be there, and sometimes I feel a need to squash them. un-Buddhist-like, I need to squash them, and they scurry away.
That's a neuroception danger.
Tiny things.
Well, that's
and,
the
and
point.
With clever, clever paths that...
I mean, apparently it doesn't take many neurons or many synapses to literally program these aversion or withdrawal reactions. But they're fast and they're clever. And, you know, if we try to catch them, we have great difficulty in their little itty-bitty neural structures. They're nothing like who we are. But they're not there cognitively saying, I've got to get out of there. The body says, get out of there. Yeah. You know, it makes that decision. It makes a neuroception. Not an awareness, not a Woody Allen internal dialogue. Do I need to do this or not do this? You know, we would not be a living species. So the threat that everyone kind of understands, we have threat. You're example of the smaller or more primitive organisms having a very well-developed threat reaction. But we kind of forgot about the evolutionary gift, or what I like to call our birthright, or claiming our birthright. And our birthright is to be safe through the cues of others. And so think about the baby who's crying is calmed down, not by a decision making, I need to calm down, but by the acoustic cues of the maternal voice. And if my voice, which is now getting more prosodic, there's a calming down of my physiology and a calming down of others. So that the communication of intonation, vocalization is a powerful neural cue to someone else's nervous system. And, you know, these are things that people intuitively know because they like to be in the presence of people who are prosodic. They don't like to be in a room where someone's yelling at them or screaming at them. So their bodies respond to this. And if you have a dog, dogs are just wonderful because they will act out their neuroception to your voice and to your intentionality. And the point I'm making is that somewhere along the line in our very sophisticated academic circles of being trained as psychologists or interested in, quote, behavior, we forgot about the power of cues of safety that shift physiology. We forgot about physiological platforms, or which create the, I would call, neural platforms to be accessible, to be socially engaging, or to be defensive.
Your theory is so wonderfully integrative, going, as you point out, from evolution, and then getting to mammals, and you know, and on up from there, and it's rooted in your understanding of the brain and the related systems, and I think just from, you know, we're talking about safety. And so I think this book actually is probably directed very much to therapists.
Yeah, it's actually, it's the 10 years later, I would say. Yeah, I mean, but the therapists are quite a broad group. So like the first chapter is really about neurocardiology. And these are cardiologists. So, but it's like, can you create a language that is congruent, consistent with the language of your marketplace, literally? And for me, it was, I wouldn't say difficult, but it was challenging. And I was asked to talk in a transdisciplinary conference in February. It was remote, but I gave the talk. And I realized in looking at the theory that it really was a totally transdisciplinary theory. It wasn't merely linked to neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, psychology, or maturation and development. It was as much a philosophy of life as it was a neuroanatomical set of structures. So I was really kind of, you know, it's like looking, I keep using the term, looking at through the rearview mirror now. And David, I think you can relate to that as our lives kind of expand.
We're looking, a lot in the rearview mirror.
Right. Today. You, for me, it's like saying, wow, those are really exciting ideas that I came up with, you know. It's almost 30 years ago. I came up with those. I said, and how did I come up with those? And then when I came up with them, I naively thought they were, in a sense, derivative, self-explanatory, and obvious. And I was just pleased to be the first one to get them out there.
And other people are going like this as you're trying to tell them about your great insights.
Now, right. But, you know, we talk about insights, or do we talk about ourselves as scholars where we are, in a sense, synthesizing, in a sense, what Google says on the shoulders of giants? Do we take credit for our ideas, or are we so pleased that our ideas are consistent with those who came before us, you know, the luminary thinkers? So if we become humble, we see ourselves as, in a sense, a voice that has been able to put together ideas. Like some of the ideas within polyvagal theory come out of neurology, the concept of dissolution, which was a John Hewlings Jackson view, which was when you get brain damage, you basically disinhibit older circuits. And that became kind of a principle within polyvagal theory, that when we're challenged on a survival level, we use our newest circuits first, which are we talk, we smile, we try to navigate. That doesn't get out of there. We run or flee. We flee or fight. And if that doesn't solve the problem, and if we can't get away like a child or someone who is being accosted, we shut down. We collapse. We appear not to be alive. And this takes on different manifestations in the world of clinical health. Like first, the person may pass out, they may defecate, they may urinate. Then the next time this happens, which may be they're in an abusive relationship or family, they may just go into a freeze. So they don't just shut down, which is functionally physiologically lethal because you're not getting enough oxygenated blood to your head, but you just keep enough sympathetic tone so you don't hit the floor. It's not a voluntary issues. The body is doing the most efficient, effective mode to keep you safe, keep you alive. So even freezing is an attempt to be safe, to survive that setting. And then what happens after repeated abuses? Dissociation. And now the body says, well, I'm not even challenging the physiology. I'm going someplace else using mental structures. It's what you start interpreting now is what we used to call pathology, as adaptive sequences of a nervous system with its quest to stay alive, quest for safety. And the portal of treatment is, in a sense, you reverse that. You basically provide cues of safety, and you convince the body that the cues of safety have validity.
Yeah, you know, we probably should talk about vagal, the vagus system, because it's right there in the title of polyvagal theory. And what your work did was to illuminate that there was another important system that had been kind of ignored, and you've kind of very in detailed ways traced how that system helps in our social interactions and. So say a little bit more about the autonomic nervous system.
Well,
basically, you created a revolution in our understanding of the autonomic nervous system, and particularly, I think, the parasympathetic nervous system.
Well, revolution is a powerful word. I don't really want to take credit for revolutions. I want to basically say I rediscovered what was already there. So if we think about the story is told to us. If we understand comparative and developmental neuroanatomy, and this is going to push people away, but the story is there because we can see a vagal pathway that is in a dorsal, the back of our brainstem. We can see that vagal components of that pathway going for a journey, moving ventrally to another area of the brainstem where it merges with the cells of origin, the neurons that control the muscles of the face and head. So suddenly our heart is projected in our voice. Suddenly our facial expressivity, suddenly our ability to listen and extract human voice is dependent upon our physiological state. So suddenly the vagus is not a diffused nerve running through all the organs. The vagus is part of our social behavior. And that journey, that story is really a remarkable story from all levels. When we think about evolution, anatomy, or we think about the study of trauma, which is, in a sense, that's the system that is most vulnerable and it gets retracted because social engagement and being safe is vulnerability to a person with a trauma history. So in a sense, doing like this for me is accessibility. If I had a severe trauma history and I even went through those motions, I would get a visceral feeling of that I could be injured. So you start seeing that the body carries or plays out these stories. So there's a beautiful narrative going on there, and that's the narrative of the repurposing of this ancient reptilian autonomic nervous system that mammals shifted to enable them to turn off threat reactions, to be safe in the presence of others, and to co-regulate, meaning not to self-regulate, which is the emphasis that we still have in education in the world. You need to take care of yourself. As a species, we evolved to co-regulate. It doesn't mean we need to be dependent and co-regulate all the time, but we need some of the time to be safe in the presence of others. And as we were talking before we went on about the pandemic, what has the pandemic done to us? It's taken away that massive portal of social co-regulation that many of us have used to, in a sense, feel good about life and feel good about ourselves. And I wrote a paper, an editorial for a psychiatry journal on what I viewed as the paradoxical challenge to our nervous system during the pandemic. The pandemic is a period of time of chronic threat because of the virus. But in the history of humanity, when we've been under threat, how have we mitigated threat? Through our social interactions. And what happened during the pandemic? Social interactions also became a threat. So now we're in a real conflict, and we're ending up with retuned autonomic nervous systems, meaning that we're more, the threshold now is lowered to be threat reactive. The threshold for chronicity of pain or even chronic COVID, long haul COVID, is really the body got over the virus, but no one told the body the virus was gone because they're still stuck in that threat state. And so the issue is our bodies crave cues of safety, because when we have cues of safety, we are basically, you know, we can be, we can trust others, we can be creative, we can be exploratory in our minds and in our bodies.
That's probably has a lot to comes into play in mating, right? That we're looking for, hopefully, because, for a safe mate.
Well, that you see, but it also, if we also think about, you talk about mating and seduction is embedded in that. What is seduction? It's just a word that doesn't carry a positive valence, but it's about sending cues of safety to another so that their defenses drop and they become accessible. Yeah. So during the mating, it's what I call working in the psychological space to send cues of safety back and forth. And then you move into a more closer proximal space and where there's physical contact. And then there's shared moments of immobilization. And that's intimacy, whether it doesn't need to be sexual, but you need those shared moments of those hugs and those, in a sense, where the bodies don't move, because movement or not moving for a mammal is vulnerability. But when you're safe in the presence of another, not moving is really the greatest feeling. You're safe.
Yeah. People like the spoon, right? That's like a real concrete image of that kind of safety of being quiet and just, you know, spooning with another person.
Or a dog or a kitten or a cat. They teach you. So having a pet, especially during the pandemic, and unfortunately we didn't have any pets. Our dogs had transitioned before pandemic.
Yeah, but us too.
And it's tough because you don't really want to get another one right away. You have a grieving period and you miss your pets. But there is this very special relationship with a dog and with a cat. And for many people, it's with horses the same way. And that is they can co-regulate with their pets. Even though people may be threatening or they may feel hypervigilant in the presence of people, in their pet, with their pets, they're like that. And the pets feel the same way. The dog going on its back, it's not submissiveness. I mean, that's what we used to be taught. That was the graduate school lesson. It's not. It's like, come tickle my belly. I want to be rubbed. I want to be touched on my ventral side. Mm-hmm. You know, it is those moments of intimacy where ventral to ventral bodies are safe, and moments that are not safe, the ventral sides are pulled across. And when we do this, we think of tightly wrapped or anxious people. And if we threw out those words, in the sense of if we got rid of our psychological heritage and said, what the hell is the body doing? This anxiety, you can call it that, but what is it? The body is in a state of threat. And it gets manifested in these higher level emotional and psychiatric.
You know, you talked about the dog on its back. I think it's a different story when the cat does that, though. We had a cat that would get on its back, and the beautiful, you know, underside of the cat with the soft looking fur and this invitation. You put your hand in there.
Oh, well, Okay, so I had a cat that I could actually throw up, and it would land, like it wouldn't go into a defensive response, even being tossed up.
We had a feral cat actually, and dangerous too.
Yeah, because when you're saying the cat started to feel safe, and it was inviting to you, but functionally the cat had a trauma history.
Yeah,
and the cues of proximity, of approach, were triggers. And the cat shifted state.
Shifted state quickly. Yeah,
right. People do that too, is what I'm also saying. Yeah. And it has very little to do with their intentionality. So the cat's intentionality, which we'll never know, may be very similar to a person with a severe trauma history. They may want to be hugged. They may want to have that close relationship. But once the proximity comes there, the body says, can't do that. Mm-hmm. And that may be the same thing with your feral cat.
Yeah. Well, your theory is, in terms of psychotherapy, is so integrative that I think a lot of different therapeutic approaches from over the years can be subsumed in some ways within this theory.
Yeah, I think that's why it has traction, and because it's not a branded therapy, but it's a what we now are calling therapies can be polyvagal informed, meaning whatever you do can be polyvagal informed. Because what we're saying is if you send cues of safety, if you functionally enable the body to become, it becomes a portal now for your therapeutic strategies.
Yes. Yes. Now, the subtitle of the book is Attachment, Communication, Self-Regulation. Attachment certainly has come to the fore in a big way in recent years. But how has a polyvagal understanding informed our understanding of attachment, communication, and self-regulation?
Well, If the title were a more accurate representation of the theory, it would be saying co-regulation, not self-regulation.
Okay.
But it really argues, or in my work, that there's really a developmental sequence of co-regulation that leads to self-regulation. It leads to boldness. And this is also kind of paradoxical with the parenting strategies that were taught from a behavioristic perspective, that was tough love and self-control. And what the theory is really saying is the body learns to regulate through co-regulation. It gets, in a sense, a resource, without always challenging it. And there's another subpart of this whole story, and that is we live in a world where we throw this another word around all the time, stress. And polyvagal theory says you don't really need that word. What you really want to say is disruption of homeostatic function. You disrupt homeostatic function when the body is responding to threat, whether internally with disease or fever or externally to a threat. You disrupt the homeostasis. And the theory basically says if you can create cues of safety within and between people, what you end up doing is supporting homeostatic function. So now you shift your conceptualization from a thought module and a body module to one nervous system conceptualization where homeostatic functions create a platform for spontaneous social behavior. And what I'm now using as a term, or let's say a phrase, is that the theory elevates sociality to that of a neural modulator. So when you brought up the vagus earlier, what I'm really saying is sociality is a vagal nerve stimulator. But polyvagal theory doesn't even like the word vagal nerve because it misses the understanding. The understanding is the nerve is merely a conduit, and those wires with many wires, and those wires are bidirectional, going from brain to body and body to brain. And we need to know where those wires go and what that regulatory system in the brainstem is. It's not the nerve. It's the regulation of those fibers. And that's occurring in the brainstem that gets information from both the body and also from higher brain structures down. So it's a much more integrated worldview. Back on your question on attachment, what it starts to focus on, and again, this goes back to a couple other things that you were asking me, is the theory intertwines maturation with disease and evolution. It basically says you have convergence of these processes. They evolve, but if you look embryologically and through early development, they develop. And when you look at disease or trauma as a model of a disease, you basically disevolve. You have dissolution. You go in reverse. So you have this predictability of a theory that is based upon evolution, based on developmental maturation, and can functionally be tested in the real world, both in the degrading of it through trauma and disease, and in the positive direction through effective therapeutic strategies.
Yeah, yeah. One of the innovations of your work, I think, was what I got from the book was that the older view of the autonomic system was kind of very top down and static, and by discovering or rediscovering, being able to describe a more complex set of interactions that is bidirectional. It's not just from the top down, but the system is communicating constantly. And you talk about the set point. We've heard about the set point, that idea that that there's a set point for around our homeostatic thing. And there again, you point out that that's really a dynamic process.
Yeah. So I think, again, you know, we've been taught a lot of things, but we've been taught about things incompletely. So we haven't gotten the full story. So we tend to think that homeostasis is about the set point, when really a homeostatic system has great variations around the set point. And in fact, again, you start seeing the model. I mentioned about development as a model. I forgot to mention about aging as a model in reverse. And one thing we recognize with aging is that the variance around that set point is decreased. So you don't move as quickly. You compensate because the nervous system isn't as agile with those oscillations. But here is the disconnect with all that. And that is the medical world that we live in, that we are dependent upon, and some of us work in and collaborate with. And that is the basic knowledge within medicine is very limited when it comes to neuroregulation of the visceral organs. So when you go to the internist, they're not asking, what's your neuroregulation of your heart? What's the neuroregulation of your kidneys or your stomach? They're looking at the organ, the end organ, as the target of disease, and they want to take blood tests or biopsies. Polyvagal thesis, that's fine. I'm not arguing that point. But the real issue is neuroregulation. And if you disrupt neuroregulation of those organs are not thriving. They're not living in their homeostatic state. That is stress. The disruption of the homeostatic state is stress. And the outcome of that is end organ disease or pathology.
Yeah.
And it means, so we've had all this lifestyle changes, positive thinking, you have all these so-called fads, but they're all kind of like touching on to a neural narrative without measuring the neural narrative. The neural narrative is enhance your feedback loops. And if we go into the world of trauma, this is where I've learned so much about what it is to be a human being, is in trauma, people go through a process, I would say it's the underlying neural survival process of downregulating neural feedback within their body. So they become numb. It becomes adaptive. And then we have a basic culture that says, don't honor your body. Don't respond to it. Sit in your chair and do the work. That's what the kids are told at school. And the kids don't want to go to school. What are they telling their parents? They have stomach aches. Go to school. But their bodies are reacting to the context of the threat that they are experiencing. And that needs to be honored.
You mentioned biofeedback, and I'm sure you're aware that there are all these devices are becoming increasingly available to give us feedback and not just in a lab, but, you know, to at home to monitor our sleep and to monitor other processes. And one of the current darlings is heart rate variability. Do you have any, you know, we're talking about that.
Well, what you don't know, David, is I published probably the first paper ever on quantifying heart rate variability in the 1960s. So that was where I started. The issue on that, it started from heart rate variability, but I stopped using that term very early because it wasn't providing any insight regarding neuroregulation. It was a descriptive term. And what I started working on is what I call neurometrics of physiology, not the physiological signal, but what can be extracted from the physiological signal regarding the neuroregulation of organs. And I still work on that. So the problem with heart rate variability is that it tends to lose its pathway of mechanism because it's a global measure of heart rate deviations, where it changes. But when you start looking at the amplitude of embedded oscillations, you start functionally measuring feedback loops. That's what those oscillations are. And then you start getting neural information, and that becomes more sensitive to disorders. And I'm actually working on, or I would say resurrecting a metric that I was working on in the late 1990s, called vagal efficiency. So rather than talking about heart rate variability or other term like cardiac vagal tone or respiratory sinus arrhythmia, which have been my pet terms that I've used for decades, I start asking the question, is that extracted measure of cardiac vagal tone, is it doing any work for you? Is it regulating your heart rate? So if I shift your postures, are your postures being changed by a pulling back of that vagal break? How efficient is the dynamic regulation of that break? And what we're finding out now is that virtually all populations that have features of dysautonomia, destabilized autonomic nervous system, have atypical, meaning low, vagal efficiency. And so meaning that your nervous system isn't tightly coupled. When it's tightly coupled, when you get up, you need more heart rate, you pull the vagal brake back, you're now seated, the brake comes back, you're calmed down again. A destabilized person, and we've all interacted with them, if they walk up a flight of steps, it's not merely that they're huffing and puffing, they're yelling and screaming at you because their physiology has shifted. And the physiology, when it shifts, creates a bias in their neuroception of the world and changes their hypersensitivity to sounds and stimuli. They go into a defensive state. If they're physiologically in a defensive state, the world is a bad world and they're hypersensitive. And we know those people. And we often say, don't have meetings with those people in the afternoon. You know, make sure you're the first person of the day to see them. You know, there are all these things we know about, but we don't measure it. In a sense, we come up and we tend to say that there's a degree of intentionality. And what I like to say is the only intentionality that we should be focusing on is whether we can give them some intention to learn to become aware of their own bodily changes and not to be angry at them, but to be honoring and respecting that. And when they go into these more defensive physiological states, that they become aware of that, and then do some help, self-help tools like breathing or biofeedback, it will calm them down. The issue is they're shifting physiological state and they're turning into defensive organisms. And we call that anger reactivity, bad bosses, you know, mean bosses.
I think you and I, something I remember from 10 years ago is that you and I both have dealt with tinnitus, ringing in our ears. And you've developed, and I don't know if it was related to your experience of tinnitus or not, but you now have a kind of a whole program with sub-programs within it called the Listening Project. So tell us how that folds into what what we're
talking
about.
That grew into what's called the Safe and Sound Protocol, and it's being distributed by a company called Unite, or Integrated Listening Systems, that was purchased by Unite. And I developed it initially really for hypersensitivities. So I was working with autism, and I was trying to figure out a way of shifting physiological state in the most non-invasive, I would say stealth-like intervention. So we know that like a modulated voice calms a baby. What if we take that clue and we computer alter vocal music and we amplify the intonation shifts? Can we create such a potent stimulus that the body can't refuse to accept it? Okay, so it goes like that. And so this program initially started out as 5 one-hour sessions, and visualize it as kind of a treadmill where the frequency bands become modulated from very narrow to broader over the 5 days. And at the end of 5 days, you're basically listening to all the frequencies that human voice, the information of human voice, is conveyed. Because people tend to have what used to be viewed as paradoxical, a hypersensitivity to sound, and the inability to extract human voice from background sound. So this is part of the aging process. So I'm going to kind of look at you and say, David, how often do you like to go into noisy bars?
Never.
Not at
all.
Because you can see mouths moving, right? And you can't extract the words.
Yeah.
That is because the neural regulation of the middle ear structures changes with maturation as well. And children who are on spectrum have some of these same issues. Their bodies are in a physiological state that doesn't have that same neural tone. So they're hypersensitive to low frequency sounds, but hyposensitive to human voice, just like mature adults like us. So we manage, what I do is make sure my back is against the wall and I can look at people while they're talking. I'm using all the knowledge I know that watching a mouth move gives me some information. But I have sensitivity and I have tinnitus too. Tinnitus, unfortunately, is inner ear. The Safe and Sound Protocol works on middle ear structures. Hmm. Middle ear structures are basically part of what I call the ventral vagal complex. They're regulated in a part of the brainstem that also is regulating your heart and your voice. And it evolved to that when we were safe and we were listening to prosodic voices, our brainstem also tuned the tension in the middle ear muscles to basically push out those lower background sounds of threat. They basically bounce off the ear, so voice comes in. So when I hear a prosodic voice, or when I used to hear prosodic voices, this system would go on and I could just hear people in noisy bars. I will say that I don't like crowded places anymore. I can't extract that information. But the Safe and Sound Protocol is there's somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 practitioners have been trained in it, which is really quite remarkable. And it's only been available for about four years now.
What sorts of practitioners are?
They're from psychiatrists to OTs to speech and hearing therapists to coaches, you know, people who have some level of certification in their own profession.
Yeah.
But the interesting part on the theoretical level is it was working just kind of, I would say, remarkably well with children and kids on spectrum. They were becoming more engaged. I'm not saying curing autism, but hypersensitivities were downregulated, so life was easier for them and for their families. But as you know, I give lots of talks in the trauma community. And the trauma community here heard me talk about it, so they got on board and wanted to try the Safe and Sound Protocol. And this has been a remarkable journey of discovery. Because what the Safe and Sound Protocol did for people with, I'm going to use the term, complex trauma, is that the additional sounds of safety, I view it now as distilled essence of trust and safety. That's what you're hearing. The initial bit was the people with complex trauma, their bodies would open up. And what is that for a person with complex trauma? It's a trigger to get the hell out of there. So they would, in a sense, what am I doing here? And they would get really mobilized and destabilized. And my initial response was, don't use it, because that's going to create a lot of destabilization. But they were very insightful and creative therapists. And they said, oh, this is wonderful. All we need to do is work slower. We need to work slower, and we need to use that feedback that the clients are feeling. We need to move that into a sense of awareness. So they basically could, maybe using a minute, it could be a few seconds, and saying, what does that feel like? Don't label it in terms of good or bad, but in a sense, feel it. Like your comment about being more Buddhist. In a sense, we need to honor our body and before we start putting labels on it. And so they've actually had really remarkable effects accelerating trauma therapies by using the Safe and Sound protocol.
You're making me think of yoga, Tai Chi, things like that that have been around for years that seem to be very effective in that sort of slowing down process.
Yeah, they also use breath. Think about that. And they focus on the exhale part of breath, which is when the vagus starts to have its impact. During inhalation, you're basically turning off the vagus. So if you want to get anxious, take long inhalations and short exhalations. If you want to calm down, using a little bit of a self-agency, you inhale rapidly and exhale slowly. You change the counts. And you basically use breath as that vagal nerve stimulator. You're calming yourself down. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You talk about play in the book as neural exercise, and that's an interesting way to conceptualize play.
Well, remember, I used the term sociality as being elevated to a level of a neural modulator. Make it important because it is important. Play has the same role. It has reciprocity. It's co-regulation. I look at you, you look at me, we move, I anticipate your movements. These are neural exercises. The issue of play, which is really transparent to people who are observers of playgrounds, is that there are some kids who play well, some that don't play well. What does it mean not to play well? And that means not to be aware of the other in your presence. It's like a social relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's why team sports are important. People are aware of their teammates. If they're not useful to the team. So you're picking up the cues of co-regulation, mm-hmm. of communication. Those are neural exercises. In my talks, I show a picture that reminds me of graduate school and taking a course in comparative psychology. And the picture I show is two kittens playing. And I'm reminded about what I was told when I was a student, and that is they're practicing their hunting skills. But from a polyvagal perspective, that's not what they're doing. If you look at them carefully, claws are retracted. They do bite, but they don't break skin. Everything is about self-regulation through co-regulation. They are practicing their ability to regulate their physiological state. They're not losing it. They're not, in a sense, getting worked up and becoming out of control, aggressive individual. And you see that, by the way, with some kids on playgrounds, they lose it. And the problem has been that we haven't leveraged the natural neural exercise of play in our school systems. We removed it. And now we have children with greater and greater difficulties in regulating their state, mm-hmm. as opposed to having opportunities to exercise a system that would enable them to regulate their state.
I'm thinking of, it seems to me that most, if not all, young mammals play.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's delightful to watch that and experience it. And we've got squirrels in our backyard and a lot of very interesting birds. And that really helps us to down-regulate. I mean, we're just looking at them and deriving benefit, even though we don't have them as, quotes, pets.
But you can now deconstruct what you're watching. You're watching reciprocity. you're watching role reversals. So what is play when squirrels, well, with dogs, it's very easy to see. They chase, well, squirrels do the same thing. They chase each other and then they role reverse. That's the play. The play is, I caught you, I'm not going to eat you, but I caught you. Now you run from me and I'll catch you. So they go back and forth. So the role reversal is a very sophisticated attribute of the play environment.
You also refer to group therapy as a neural exercise, as opposed to one-on-one therapy.
Well, one-on-one therapy can be a neural exercise, but it has a lot to do with the orientation of the therapist. So if group therapy, by definition, is eye gaze and facial engagement and listening and talking, so it has all this reciprocity in it. One-on-one therapy has the range. It often has a lot of, let's say, pontification going on or interpretation. And I think that limits the neural exercise and places the burden on a top-down intentionality. And that's why many clients have basically, they walk over to the more alternative, which are more body-oriented, more somatic-oriented, because they have greater reciprocity, whether we call it yoga or dance movement therapies. They have a degree of activity, list engagement, and reciprocity.
Going back to your talked about polyvagal-informed therapy. Yeah. What would be the features of a polyvagal-informed therapy?
Well, they would be, first of all, the ability to be aware of your client's physiological state and to respect it. So it's understanding that facial expressivity, intonation of voice, muscle tension, or tightness of the body is conveying information about physiological state. It would also mean that one of your goals as a therapist is to calm your client. You're not going to make progress unless the physiological state of the client is calm enough to be accessible. We can deconstruct that and say the ventral or the newer mammalian vagus starts controlling, and that's linked with the social engagement system. And when that's on board, social behavior contains all our defensive reactions. We calm, and then you can work with the client in a very efficient way. In this sense, the therapist is being welcomed and the client's being more accessible. But it's basically reciprocal, meaning the therapist has to be accessible as well and has to be projecting cues of acceptance and witnessing of the other.
As we wind down, I want to go back to COVID. Do you have any suggestions of how people who are sequestering or, you know, what can they do to enhance their vagal tone, I guess, to put it in your terms?
I think it's a good, really good question. And I talk from a perspective that I've experienced COVID and I have felt the retuning of my autonomic nervous system. And I had, prior to COVID, I was traveling a lot and engaging people, giving people hugs, giving talks. And I know that I've been retuned because the thought of that now is something I don't look forward to. But
I've gone through something like that myself, and I feel a little guilty about it.
Yeah, well, we're healthy, we're surviving, we're not food insecure, home insecure, on all levels we're doing well. While, 750,000 people have died, and we're in a country where no one's done any, in a sense, public grieving of this massive effect on our culture. And it's going to be there. We have to do a healing because it's affected so many people. But for me, first of all, I acknowledge that I have been retuned, and I've been retuned to me, I would say, more threat oriented. That's really what we're saying, that cues of others or people I don't know are not cues of safety anymore. They're not cues of of curiosity and wanting to meet. I go to an airplane. I don't want to go to an airport. I mean, it's like too many of these stories of outrageous behaviors on planes. I just don't want to expose my body to it. So for me, what I've done is I actually leverage two things I do. I feel we live on the ocean front. I love that because love the ocean sound. I love it. Like we have squirrels and we have birds and we have birds overhead and, you know, birds nesting. So being near living nature is part of a connectedness that you can feel. Walking on the beach is part of it as well. But I use Zoom. I use the internet as nourishment. So I'm on most days, and that's why I'm on with you, because I view it as a way for me to connect and to interact with others. It's not the same as having coffee at Starbucks, which is the way I like to say it, but it's not bad. And I've learned to, in a sense, enjoy it and take these moments of interaction where, if you know, pre-COVID, it might have been, I might be toiling, in a sense, looking at the clock, can't wait to get off so I can do something else. No, I'm present during my podcasts and interviews. And being present is really giving to me as well as my ability to give to others who are joining us.
Well, thank you for that and for helping to tune me up here as we've been talking and interacting. And I look forward to that time when maybe we would have a chance to have a cup of coffee together.
Look forward to that. Yeah. Talk about what it was like in the 60s. You were in Ann Arbor and I was in East Lansing, and we can share those moments. And, before we go, what was the name of the bar down there? Because I went once that where they had band. It was very...
In Ann Arbor?
Yeah, very famous. But it was with bands, and so I went once with a group of my friends.
I'll try to remember it.
The one in East Lansing was called the Gables, but there was something nicer in Ann Arbor. I went to that once. But I'll think about it, and next time I won't forget. Listen, good to see you again. Stay healthy.
Thanks for my guest being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and Godspeed in your work and your growing community. What a privilege it is to speak again with my guest, Dr. Stephen W. Porges, the originator of the polyvagal theory, about his most recent book, Polyvagal Safety, Attachment, Communication, Self-Regulation. I say privilege because I'm pretty sure that he's one of the most influential living psychologists. His theory has already had a huge impact not only on psychology and psychotherapy, but a number of other disciplines as well. As he writes in the introductory chapter, and I quote, "When the polyvagal theory was initially conceptualized, I didn't consider it as an expansive, paradigm-shifting model. In developing it, I thought it was consistent with antecedent research and theory. In a way, I thought it was the obvious next step. During the 25 years following the initial presentation of the polyvagal theory, through my experiences with the scientific community across many disciplines, I learned that the theory provides the framework for a new brain-body or mind-body science. Moreover, I learned that as health-related disciplines embrace the theory, a new polyvagal-informed strategy could be embedded in mental and physical health treatment models. This strategy would focus on recruiting the nervous system of the client or patient as a collaborator on a shared journey toward wellness." Close quote. Porges is first and foremost a scientist. I appreciate the way in our interview he shared the observation made by one of his peers, referring to him as, quotes, "a scientist with a heart." Indeed, in the interview, I was impressed by his humility. He revealed that being open and vulnerable did not come easily to him, yet his theory really demanded that of him. It wasn't enough to write that our evolutionary history reveals that our own survival as a species is rooted in kindness and sociability. he would have to learn to manifest those qualities in himself. He would have to learn to communicate that he is a trustworthy, well-intentioned person so that others could let down their defenses and reveal their own vulnerabilities. He's not only a scientist, but also a therapist. About his theory, he writes, quote, simply stated, the theory uncovered the structures and portals through which our neurobiological quest for safety through connectedness with others may be implemented, close quote. At the time he began to develop his theory, he had to go up against well-established notions about the autonomic nervous system, and particularly by the parasympathetic branch of that system, which focused on fight-or-flight reactions to threat. He found the conventional model to be quite static and top-down, emphasizing cortical control. He writes, my scientific origins are rooted in the world of psychophysiology, a science that emerged in the 1960s to study how physiological responses paralleled psychological phenomena such as mental effort, attention, expectancy, stimulus detection, decision-making, truthfulness, and preference. At the time I first presented the polyvagal theory, arousal theory was prevalent in psychophysiology. Although arousal theory had a long, influential history in science, it had a relatively simplistic underlying model, close quote. His polyvagal theory, by contrast, emphasizes bidirectional communication between brain centers, where conventional thinking emphasized top-down communication. Polyvagal theory paints a much more fluid and dynamic picture. Although he didn't use the word holistic in our discussion, I think it fits. I suspect, though, that he would find that description too imprecise. Of his own approach, he writes, and I quote, in contrast to the prevalent working models of my colleagues, polyvagal theory emphasized bidirectional communication between the brain and the visceral organs represented in the autonomic nervous system. Close quote. Dr. Porges shared with us that he felt compelled to coin a new word, neuroception, to underscore that our bodies are primed to keep us safe. He writes, quote, neuroception is the process through which the nervous system evaluates risk without requiring awareness. This automatic process involves brain areas that evaluate cues of safety, danger, and life threat. Once these are detected via neuroception, physiological state automatically shifts to optimize survival. Close quote. One of the unique and most important features of polyvagal theory is the way it helps to illuminate the workings of social engagement. Porges writes, quote, it is through the social engagement system that individuals broadcast their physiological state in their voices and faces. Astute therapists intuitively detect these features and appropriately co-regulate their clients into calmer and more accessible states. Close quote. He goes on to say, quote, it's a theory about our human interface with the world and our need for safety and connection through trusting relationships, close quote. In addition to his introduction, the book has 14 chapters, each addressing a clinical application. Some of the chapters are written entirely by Porges himself, and some by other authors with Porges contributing. These chapters cover such issues as play, group therapy, human-animal interactions, autism, and the COVID-19 pandemic. There is also an appendix chapter meant to be a primer on polyvagal theory. Personally, I found the primer not to be as simple as the word implies. Once again, I feel so privileged to be able to speak with one of the greats of our time, who comes across as humble and self-revealing. Indeed, he made me feel safe and calm instead of nervous and overwhelmed by his stature in the field. Thank you for that, Stephen.
Hey, Dr. Dave. Thanks for bringing us your show. I value the open-heartedness and humor you show your guests and all of us as you delve into topics. It informs both my personal journey and my work with clients. I give to Shrink Wrap Radio for the same reason I give to other institutions that feed my mind and heart. It's to complete the energetic circuit. As I receive, so I give. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Ron Sala, for your ongoing support and for sharing your wonderful rationale. I hope others will take heart from your recommendation and keep the circuit going. As I review the honor roll in putting together today's podcast, I'm so appreciative of all you monthly donors. In fact, I'd like to read out the names of monthly donors whose donations have landed in the last several days. Sebastian Filsek, Cynthia Moore, Sue Ellen Taylor, Hank Smith, Asher Hartman, and Penny McKenna. Thank you so much. And of course, thank you to all you other monthly supporters. Your regular donations mean so much to me personally and also help to support the regular expenses that the show incurs. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Thanks again to the very influential scientist and author, Stephen W. Porges, PhD, for discussing his latest book, Polyvagal Safety, Attachment, Communication, Self-Regulation. Next week, my return guest will be psychiatrist and author David Burns, MD, discussing his book, Feeling Great, The Revolutionary New Treatment for Depression and Anxiety. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.